Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents American Heritage, History of the Indian Wars by Robert M. Utley and Wilcome E. Washburn. Read by David Drummond. Part 1. The East. Chapter 1. Opening Guns. The morning of Good Friday, March 22, 1622, began much like any other in the English settlements scattered for 100 miles up and down the James River in the colony of Virginia. On many of the plantations, unarmed groups of Indians arrived early and, as was customary, were invited into the houses, where they were given breakfast, and began to barter fish, furs, turkeys, and deer for glass beads and other trinkets. Up the river at Henrico, the westernmost town of the colony, clergyman George Thorpe was at his devotions. Thorpe, whom one contemporary described as a most sufficient gentleman, virtuous and wise, had left the king's privy chamber to establish a school in the New World and to convert the Indians there to Christianity. He was delighted with his progress. He felt that he had gained the trust and friendship of the natives, and had even built a house after the English fashion for Opechancano, leader of the powerful Powhatan Confederacy of Tidewater Indian tribes. A few miles beyond, at Falling Creek, 100 skilled workmen were building an iron foundry that the Virginia Company had sent them from England to establish. And all along the river, men and women were planting tobacco and corn, sawing timber, making bricks, feeding livestock. The sun reached the angle of 8 o'clock, and fury burst upon the settlers with terrible suddenness. The Indians in the houses grabbed the weapons of their hosts, whom, as one report put it, they basely and barbarously murdered, not sparing either age or sex, man, woman, or child. Thorpe was among the first to be killed. One of his servants sensed what was about to happen and tried to warn him to defend himself, but Thorpe, refusing to believe the man, was cut down without resisting. The Indians swarmed into the foundry, killed the mill master and his men, burned the buildings, and wrecked the machinery. Later, the Virginia Company was able to salvage no more than a pair of tongs, a shovel, and one bar of iron. Men and women taken by surprise in the fields were immediately put to death. But where people had time to resist, they generally survived. At one plantation, for instance, a boy frightened off the attackers simply by discharging a musket into the air, and the settlers in a home nearby successfully defended themselves with spades, axes, and brickbats. Jamestown was saved by an Indian boy named Chanko, the Christian servant of a Mr. Pace. Chanko's brother had ordered him the night before to kill Pace, but the boy could not bring himself to do it, and he told his master of the danger. Pace secured his home for the coming fight, and then, before daylight, rode across the James River to alert the governor. When the hour came, the capital was ready. Even so, the assault was effective enough to wipe out 1/3 of the entire colony. There fell 347, and not being content with taking away life alone, they, the Indians, fell after again upon the dead, making as well as they could a fresh murder, defacing, dragging, and mangling the dead carcasses into many pieces, and carrying some parts away in derision, with base and brutish triumph. This bloody attack, the worst yet experienced by the English in the New World, devastated the settlers at a time when they thought they could count on peaceful relations with the Indians. The immediate cause was the death of Nemetanahue, an Indian executed by the English in retribution for the murder of a man named Morgan. But, in fact, the war that erupted with the 1622 massacre was no more fought over a single Indian than the First World War was fought over a Central European archduke. The source of the conflict was foreshadowed by the first European footstep on the shores of the New World, when Columbus waded onto the beach of a beautiful Caribbean island, certain that he had landed on the edge of the rich and fabled Orient. That landing was the real beginning of the 400-year chronicle of idealism, illusion, courage, cruelty, and greed that brought Native Americans and European invaders together in a struggle for possession of a continent. The treasures of the East, silk fabrics, jewels, spices, porcelain objects, together with such phenomena as gunpowder and the printing press, had long roused the envy and admiration of Europe. Compared with the Orient, Europe was an underdeveloped region. Its population was minuscule beside that of China, Japan, and India. Its economy was weak and limited, and its rural nation-states petty and fragmented. Europeans were designated barbarians by the haughty Chinese and Japanese, clever barbarians, perhaps, but barbarians, nevertheless. The bewilderment of the early explorers at finding a new continent was evident in their refusal to believe that they had found it. Columbus, who named the inhabitants of the New World Indians in the belief that he had reached India, persisted in this conviction until his dying day. Carrying diplomatic letters to the Great Khan, politely and respectfully stating his peaceful intentions, Columbus searched fruitlessly for signs of vast cities and silk-clad philosophers in the jungles of Cuba. He finally decided that while he had reached Asia, he was still on its outskirts, among the lands in the Sea of India, described by Marco Polo as inhabited by naked men with simpler societies than those of the Chinese and Japanese. When Columbus's men showed their weapons to the hospitable natives of the island of Guanahani, which Columbus renamed San Salvador, the Indians cut themselves on the sharp blades of the Spanish swords from ignorance of their character. The New World had not yet entered its Age of Iron. Its weapons were still those of the Stone Age. The disparity between the military strength of Europe, represented by gunpowder, steel, and the horse, and that of the New World, whose inhabitants fought with bows and arrows and wooden clubs, was immediately apparent to the European soldiery, who quickly saw the human population of the New World as a resource to be exploited. The attitude was prefigured in Columbus's journal entry of October 14, 1492, suggesting the establishment of a fortress, though I do not see that it would be necessary, for these people are very simple as regards the use of arms, as your highnesses will see from the 7 that I caused to be taken to bring home and learn our language and return. Unless your highnesses should order them all to be brought to Castile, or to be kept as captives on the same island, for with 50 men they can all be subjugated, and made to do what is required of them. This ease of conquest was not lost on the hard-handed crew that Columbus ordered to establish a Spanish city at La Navidad on Hispaniola, while he returned to Spain to carry news of the discovery. He had barely departed when the soldiers set out after women and gold. With their leader safely beyond the horizon, they roamed the island, descending on villages and taking golden ornaments from the natives at sword point. In time, the Castilians would formalize this sort of robbery into the system of repartimientos and encomiendas, which meant that the natives labored in gold mines and on plantations, in return for which their masters were supposed to instruct them in the Christian faith. It was little more than slavery. Women murdered their own children rather than have them live under the conquistadors. The Spanish also had a leaning toward gratuitous cruelty. Bartolomé de las Casas, the first priest to be ordained in the New World, worked long and fruitlessly against the bloody excesses of his countrymen, of which he gave this stark description: overrunning cities and villages where they spared no sex nor age, neither would their cruelty pity women with child, whose bellies they would rip up, taking out the infant to hew it in pieces. They would often lay wagers who should with most dexterity either cleave or cut a man in the middle, or who could at one blow soonest cut off his head. The children they would take by the feet and dash their innocent heads against the rocks, and when they were fallen into the water, with a strange and cruel derision, they would call upon them to swim. Sometimes they would run both mother and infant, being in her belly, quite through, at one thrust. They erected certain gallowses that were broad, but so low that the tormented creatures might touch the ground with their feet, upon every one of which they would hang 13 persons, blasphemously affirming that they did it in honor of our Redeemer and his apostles, and then, putting fire under them, they burnt the poor wretches alive. Though they lacked the terrifying weapons and horses of the invaders, The natives rebelled against this tyranny when they dared. The garrison left at La Navidad was the first to feel their wrath. One night, the Indians surprised 10 Spaniards asleep in their huts, each with several women sleeping around him. Some of the Spaniards were killed outright. The others were driven into the ocean and drowned. Emboldened by their success, the natives hunted down the rest of the soldiers, who were out freebooting around the countryside. When Columbus returned in 1493, not one was left alive. Though La Navidad was wiped out, the Spanish built new cities. Within a generation of establishing their first foothold in the islands of the Caribbean, they were moving into the vast unexplored continent beyond. The first two ships to drop anchor in the 1520s, off the coast of what would become the Carolinas, found there a gentle, kindly, hospitable people, whom the sailors named the Chicoreans. They invited scores of these Indians aboard ship, offered them a look at the lower decks, and while the visitors were inspecting the holds, locked them in and set sail for Santo Domingo, where the Chicoreans were sold as mine slaves. Other slavers pursued these easy pickings, and by the end of the 17th century, the tribe had disappeared from the face of the earth, as had the inhabitants of many of the West Indian islands. In 1529, Pánfilo de Narváez, a red-bearded, one-eyed roughneck, came fresh from pillaging in Mexico to try his luck in the Gulf Coast villages. He opened negotiations with the natives around Tampa Bay by luring their chief and his family into the Spanish camp, cutting off the chief's nose, and ordering his mother torn apart by dogs. Narváez went on to take his army of 400 men up the coast. Eventually, he overplayed his hand and saw his command destroyed by Indians, exhaustion, exposure, and disease. Only 4 soldiers survived the expedition. Hernando de Soto's subsequent march through the southeastern part of the country in 1540-42 and Coronado's expeditions in the southwest in the same period showed the inland tribes that they could expect the worst from the bearded white men. Both Coronado and de Soto assumed that the local Indians should provide food, guides, and porters to carry their supplies and facilitate their search for portable wealth. When they suspected that a guide was deceitful, they killed him. If they thought an Indian ruler was less than cooperative, they often seized him to extort further concessions from his followers. The Spaniards burned villages and enslaved or killed their hosts, in the conviction that terror and intimidation could serve their purposes better than any policy of kindness and accommodation. In these practices, they merely followed on a smaller scale the practices of Cortés in Mexico and Pizarro in Peru. Unfortunately for the Spanish, the country north of the Rio Grande could not provide the riches in gold, silver, and slaves that Central and South America afforded. Nevertheless, the pattern of extortion and terror continued. And always, as the conquistadors cut their way through the New World, disease went with them, continuing the slaughter where the swords and the primitive guns, called harquebuses, left off. Smallpox, measles, and a score of other illnesses ravaged the Indians, who had had no chance to build up the immunities developed by Europeans during the terrible epidemics of the Middle Ages. Estimates of Indian population vary widely, but the first Spanish tribute rolls in Mexico indicate a native population of 15 million. By the early 1600s, the number had dwindled to about 2 million. Such, then, was the groundwork the Spanish had prepared for other European settlers who came later. It was a legacy of unnecessary cruelty and death, bequeathed by sword and disease. In 1570, the essayist Montaigne looked upon these works and despaired. So many goodly cities ransacked and razed, so many nations destroyed or made desolate, so infinite millions of harmless people of all sexes, status, and ages massacred, ravaged, and put to the sword, and the richest, the fairest, the best part of the world turned upside down, ruined, and defaced, for the traffic of pearls and peppers. O mechanic victories! O base conquest! When the English came to establish their first permanent colony at Jamestown in 1607, They, too, hoped to find gold and a passage to India. But they also sought furs, sassafras, then believed to be a cure for syphilis, and anything else that could make a profit for the Virginia Company of London, the joint stock operation that was financing the colony. This English foray into the Virginia wilderness had been designed with political and economic ends in mind. A few pious remarks were made about introducing the Indian to Christianity, but there was little real missionary zeal. Nor could the English have spread the gospel at sword point, even if they had wished to. The first years of the colony were wretched ones. Of the 900 settlers who arrived during the first 3 years, only 150 remained alive in 1610. Most of the dead were taken by disease and starvation, not by Indians. There were a few bloody squabbles, but for the most part, the Indians, who could so easily have extinguished the flagging settlement, let it alone. These forbearing natives were members of an Algonquian confederacy of Indians, some 200 villages and 32 tribes, with a total population of about 10,000. This empire, as it has been called, had been stitched together by a determined chieftain named Wahunsinakawa, whom the colonists called King Powhatan, after the town where he lived. Powhatan's Indians not only permitted the settlement to survive, but actually helped the English during the first desperate winters. Captain John Smith, the principal military agent at Jamestown, wrote, "It pleased God, in our extremity, to move the Indians to bring us corn, ere it was half ripe, to refresh us. When we rather expected, they would destroy us." But it is significant that, to Smith, it was the English God, rather than the Indians' generosity, that got the corn to his table. The English showed little hesitation about attacking the Indians, for whatever reason. Once tobacco began to be cultivated after 1614 to meet the growing demand in England, the pressure on Indian lands increased. Tobacco cultivation exhausted the soil quickly, forcing the planters to move on to new fields, and it was far easier for the colonists to take over fields that the Indians had already cleared than to go through the tedious labor of felling trees and grubbing stumps. Captain Smith had set the pattern for Virginia's conduct toward the Indians in the period when the colonists seized rather than grew their crops. As he wrote, "The wars in Europe, Asia, and Africa taught me how to subdue the wild salvages in Virginia. Arrogant, truculent, possessed of immense physical courage, Smith was perhaps the quintessential 17th-century military commander. Once, having gone upriver to barter for corn with Opechancano, the half-brother of Powhatan, he found himself surrounded by hundreds of well-armed Indians. Coolly assessing the situation, Smith seized Opechancano by his scalp lock, stuck a pistol in his ribs, and thrust him out in front of the throng. 'Here I stand,' he bellowed. 'Shoot he that dare. You promised to fraught my ship with corn ere I departed, and so you shall, or I mean to load her with your dead carcasses.' He got the corn. Powhatan clearly perceived the English intentions, and yet hoped against hope for a peaceful accommodation. Smith quotes Powhatan in a conversation of 1609. 'Captain Smith,' saith the king, 'some doubt I have of your coming hither. For many do inform me, your coming is not for trade, but to invade my people and possess my country.' Powhatan went on to sketch the advantages of peace over war, when he would be so hunted by you that I can neither rest, eat, nor sleep, but my tired men must watch, and if a twig but break, everyone cry, 'There comes Captain Smith!' Then must I fly, I know not whither, and thus, with miserable fear, end my miserable life." The tactics used by the English in their warfare with the Indians crossed the foggy dividing line between strategic deception and outright immorality. Early instructions from the Virginia Company's London directors advocated taking Powhatan prisoner as a means of bringing him under control. If that proved impossible, Sir Thomas Gates, who became governor in 1611, was urged to make tributaries of as many chiefs as possible, and even to put to death the Indian priests. In one case, Gates lured Indians into the open by having his soldiers beat a drum and dance. When the Indians came out, Gates slaughtered them. The seizure of Pocahontas by Samuel Argall in 1613 provided another instance of English deception, though it brought years of relative peace to the fledgling colony. Despite all such provocations, Poetan worked to avoid violence. Then, in 1618, he died, and Opechancano succeeded him as ruler of the Confederacy. Poetan's half-brother pledged his help and friendship to the colonists, but he smarted from the humiliations and extortions his people continued to receive, and he bided his time. That time came, early in March 1622, shortly after the planter named Morgan went inland to trade with the Indians and never returned. The Englishman's servants, thinking that Nemetunahu had done Morgan in, put the Indian to death. Nemetunahu had been a man of some standing, and Opechancano threatened vengeance. The colonists responded with threats of their own. The case against Nemetunahu, even as reported by John Smith, seemed flimsy. The Indian was said to have returned to Morgan's friends and servants wearing the dead man's hat on his head, hardly something a murderer could be expected to do. Then, according to Smith, Nemetunahu so moved their patience, they shot him. That bare sentence suggests the Indian's outraged rejection of the implication that he was guilty. And it is not hard to imagine a series of other fatal misunderstandings in the emotionally charged atmosphere in which the information about Morgan's murder was transmitted. A few months before the massacre, Opechancano had assured the English that he held the peace so firm the sky should fall, or ere he dissolved it. But now, to Governor Francis Wyatt, he openly talked of revenge. Visiting the far-flung tribes of his confederation, he engineered a coordinated attack to be launched all along the James River at the same hour. It took him 2 weeks to complete the arrangements. On March 20th, according to Smith, Opechancano guided some planters with much kindness through the woods, and one Brown that lived among them to learn the language was sent home in safety. 2 days later, on Good Friday, the storm broke on the unsuspecting settlers. Though they may not have realized it, as they waited grimly for casualty reports from the outlying settlements, the English in Jamestown had reached a turning point in their relations with the Indians. Whatever actual and potential goodwill had previously existed went up with the smoke of the burning settlements. From that time on, the predominant English policy would be one of extermination. "It is infinitely better," wrote Wyatt, "to have no heathen among us who were but as thorns in our sides, than to be at peace and league with them." The colonists set about rooting the natives out of the entire Tidewater area. Regular patrols attacked neighboring Indian villages again and again. Disease broke out in the colonists' ranks, but they persevered with their offensive. "With our small and sickly forces," wrote one of them, "we have discomforted the Indians round about us, burnt their houses, gathered their corn, and slain not a few. Although they are as swift as roebucks, like the violent lightning they are gone as soon as perceived, and not to be destroyed but by surprise or famine." By January 1623, the Virginia Council of State could report that more Indians had been killed in the previous year than had been slain since the beginning of the colony. As the campaign wore on, the colonists resorted to measures ruthless enough to draw a rebuke from the Virginia Company itself. The chiding came when the company got word that Governor Wyatt had tried to poison Opechancano during a feigned peace conference. The attempt was bungled, and although 200 Indians became violently ill and many were slaughtered, Opechancano escaped. The council responded to the company's protests, "We hold nothing unjust that may tend to their ruin. Stratagems were ever allowed against all enemies, but with these neither fair war nor good quarter is ever to be held, nor is there other hope of their subversion, whoever may inform you to the contrary." For 14 years, through the chilly winters and the malarial summers, the English continued their lethal pressure against the Indians. Finally, in 1632, the military efforts of both settlers and natives ground to a halt through mutual exhaustion. Each side grudgingly recognized the authority of the other in its own territory, and a weary, sullen truce settled over the Tidewater. The respite lasted little more than a decade. Opechancano, very old now but still canny and capable, went up and down the river in 1644, once again organizing an attack against the English. It came on the morning of April 18th, and the few colonists who could recall the events of 1622 must have reacted with particular shock as they got word of the assault that had rolled over the isolated, scattered settlements. But it was not quite like 1622. For one thing, the Indians backed off after their first offensive. Nobody knows why this curious lethargy settled over the attackers. Perhaps some omen discouraged them. But rather than pressing home their initial advantage, they disappeared into the forest. And while they killed upward of 400 settlers, Virginia's white population then stood at 8,000. The attack, though costly, was not devastating. The colonists had a new royal governor, Sir William Barclay, who wasted no time in launching a counterattack. He dispatched small groups of well-armed men who penetrated deep into Indian territory, burning fields and destroying natives wherever they could be found. In June, the General Assembly passed an act calling for perpetual war with the Indians guilty of the attack. Seeking assistance from the mother country, the Assembly sent Sir William, whose connections at court were known to be good, over to England, to procure a supply of arms and ammunition from His Majesty. The mission was not particularly successful, for Barclay found his country locked in a bloody civil war in which he briefly joined, fighting with the forces of Charles I against those of Parliament. When he returned to America in June 1645, the conflict with the Indian Confederation was still unresolved. Although several forts had been built and expeditions continued to be sent into hostile country, Opechancano remained a threat to the colony's existence. By March 1646, the Assembly had wearied of the apparently interminable fighting, and considering the almost impossibility of a further revenge upon them, they being dispersed and driven from their towns and habitations, lurking up and down the woods in small numbers, and that a peace, if honorably obtained, would conduce to the better being and commodity of the country, Captain Henry Fleet, the colony's interpreter, was authorized to take 60 men, find Opechancano, and make peace. But before Fleet could move, Barclay happened to learn the whereabouts of the Indian leader and set off with a troop of soldiers to raid his headquarters. Opechancano was captured and taken to Jamestown. When the Indian leader, who was nearly 100 years old and virtually blind, heard a great noise of the treading of people about him, he caused his eyelids to be lifted up, and finding that a crowd of people were let in to see him, he called in high indignation for the governor, who being come, Opechancano scornfully told him that had it been his fortune to take Sir William Barclay prisoner, he should not meanly have exposed him as a show to the people. Stung by the rebuke, Barclay ordered him treated with appropriate courtesy. The governor's order was not obeyed. Opechancano was shot in the back by one of his guards. A peace of sorts with Necatoanque, Opechancano's successor, was finally made by the Assembly in October 1646. Necatoanque acknowledged his dependence upon the King of England and agreed that his successors might be appointed or confirmed by the King's governors. 20 beaver skins were to be presented annually to the governor as a sign of the nation's subjection. Boundaries were set between Necatoanque's land and the English settlements, with each side forbidden to enter the other's territory except as authorized by the governor. For the first time, the legal right of Virginia's Indians to the lands they occupied was formally recognized. The policy of perpetual enmity and the campaigns of extermination were replaced, at least temporarily, by a policy of mutual right. The defeat of Opechancano, whose federation had formed the only major obstacle in the Tidewater area, cleared the way for English expansion up to the rapids or heads of navigation of Virginia's rivers, and set the stage for later migration into the rolling Piedmont area leading to the Great Appalachian Barrier. Because of the Civil War in England, which culminated in the execution of Charles I in 1649, controlling this expansion proved difficult. Although Governor Barclay persuaded the assemblies of the late 1640s to restrict and even displace English settlements that were too scattered for their own safety or that impinged on the rights of the native inhabitants, the pressure of Virginia's growing population proved impossible to throttle. When
sample complete. Ready to continue?